I'm Tom Martin, and welcome to Eastern Standard, a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University. Produced with the support of 1, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, and Dynamics Productions. In this edition, we look at efforts being made to bring onto the same wavelength the kinds of degrees and certifications being provided by our schools and training centers, and the skills and talents that are actually in demand in today's and tomorrow's labor market.
We often talk about needing more business education partnerships to make sure that we get that alignment right, so that the business community is being really clear about what they want and need, and the education and training community is being responsive to that.
We'll hear about one of these alignments happening right here at Eastern Kentucky University, new funding for aviation maintenance training.
People were saying that they needed the aviation mechanics program because there was a need that needed to be fulfilled, and we were able to bring this program.
We'll hear about a state program that can hook you up with world markets if you're a small business with an interest in becoming an exporter. WEKU's Mary Meehan has been to Wyoming to find out how they're using telemedicine technology as a lifesaver for rural victims of domestic abuse and sexual assault. We have a report on Kentucky counties that rely on packing their jails to raise revenues. And have you gotten one of these calls on your cell phone?
Now, if I don't hear a call from you, we will have to issue an arrest warrant under your name and get you arrested. So get back to me as soon as possible. Thank you.
We'll have a report on the latest phone scam raising eyebrows and hackles across the state. We begin the hour with a title to ponder: Slaves, Slaveholders, and a Kentucky Community's Struggle Toward Freedom. The author is Elizabeth Leonard, the Gibson Professor of History at Colby College in Waterville, Maine, and she's author of several books on the Civil War era. Thanks for joining us, Elizabeth.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
And first, I'm curious, briefly as possible, can you tell us how a scholar in Maine has come around to telling this particular Kentucky story?
Yes. Well, I have been doing Civil War scholarship for my entire professional career, and Joseph Holt, who is one of the main characters in the story, has cropped up so many times that I finally decided I needed to give him more attention, even though my initial focus was certainly not on Kentucky. But then I was drawn into his story through other stories I was trying to tell, and that led me to Kentucky and then to his house and then to his community and so on. And as you probably know from looking at my bio, I wrote his biography, and this book grows out of questions that remained for me after I wrote his biography.
Okay, let's sort out the people involved in this story. First, there was the Holt family in Breckenridge
right.
County, Kentucky.
That's correct. So that's Joseph Holt and then his siblings and his parents and his siblings' children and so on. And then, of course, they would have called it their family. I'm not sure the enslaved persons would have called it family, but there were many slaves who were part of that community as well and connected to the Holt family in one way or another.
And also very key to this story is one in particular among the tens of thousands of former slaves who enlisted to fight for the Union's survival and for the end of slavery. Tell us about him.
Right. His name is Sandy, and I was drawn into his story because I was thinking about Joseph Holt and how it was that he went from being a slaveholder for most of his life to being someone who so adamantly opposed slavery later in his life. And I wondered what happened to his slaves and if I could have traced any of them specifically. And I had encountered some names along the way in my research about him, one of which was Sandy's. And I decided to see if I could find Sandy in the historical record, which, as you I'm sure know, it's very hard to find individual slaves in the historical record and tell their stories. But I was able to locate him through some wonderful digitized resources and then follow up on his story. So that's how he becomes a central figure.
So can you tell us how these very disparate lives, even though they were living together in the same property and same place, how they were woven into the same fabric, if you will?
Well, I think that the story I tell in this book is a great example of how the war affected even small communities in very different, complicated ways. So Joseph Holt, the person that led me into this story, ended up leaving Kentucky and going to Washington and serving in Lincoln's administration and being a passionate advocate for emancipation and the enlistment of black soldiers and so on, and black civil rights after the war. Most of his white family in Breckinridge County remained adamant pro-Confederate, Southern nationalist, pro-slavery people, except for one aunt who was kind of an interesting character. And then, of course, there were the black people who lived, the slaves who lived in the community, who obviously hoped to fight for their own freedom. And so I try to tell the stories of the different members of this family. And the focus on Sandy and on Joseph is on how, from very different social positions, these two men fought for the same goal from very different places in very different ways and with very different long-term outcomes. But their lives do, in a funny way, come back together after the war, and the whole community sort of comes back together after the war. So that's kind of interesting, too.
Well, what sorts of observations about black enlistments contributed to Joseph Holt's evolving consciousness and his political transformation?
I would say he was profoundly moved by the willingness of the slaves who ran away from these horrible systems of enslavement, horrible and cruel, nevertheless, not only to fight for their freedom, but to fight for the Union and the sacrifices they were willing to make despite the kind of torment they had lived in their own lives and for generations and so on. I think he was impressed. And there were, of course, many white Americans who believed, oh, they'll never fight, or oh, they'll crumble under fire, or oh, this or oh, that. And he was very attentive to the courage and sacrifice of these soldiers. And that really did help to shape his views, although he was also shaped by his horror at the fact that a whole section of the country would destroy the country in order to save an institution like slavery, which he had been ambivalent about, you know, for some time.
And you mentioned earlier that he definitely was not on the same wavelength with many members of his immediate family.
Right.
Did he pay a price for that?
He certainly did. He paid a very powerful personal price with many of his family members becoming very hostile, even one nephew threatening to kill him if he ever came back into the community. And there was a real breach in the family that healed very, very slowly, and I would say never quite completely, but a younger generation years after the war reached out to him and tried to draw him back into the family circle, and he did ultimately go back to Kentucky. After he died, he made sure that he had planned in advance that his body would return to the family homestead. So there was some healing, but it was a terrible breach, and he suffered grievously for it.
I'm wondering, Elizabeth, having done the research on this and written this account, are you picking up echoes of the divisions of the Civil War era in present-day America?
Yes. Although I will say I started the book in what to me were happier, more congenial times. I started the research, but I finished the book in light of the more divisive quality of our culture today, and I it did seem to have certain echoes, a little bit of hopefulness in terms of, you know, looking back at a community 150 years ago that was able to find some sort of healing, but I would not want to over-romanticize, you know, what was accomplished after the Civil War and assume that we can happily, you know, live through what we're living through now and get to the other side. But there were signs of hope as well as, you know, the clear evidence of division and powerful, powerful anger, rage, violence.
As a historian and as a Civil War scholar in particular, what about that old saw that history has a way of repeating itself? Are we in danger of that at all?
Oh, I think so. I feel that we, I mean, as a Civil War historian, I will, and as someone who's been teaching American history for many years and also has lived, you know, I was born in 1957, so I've seen a good chunk of, you know, recent American history, and I will say I have never been quite as anxious about the future of the country as I am now, and have never felt like we were as close to the sort of rupture that we saw in the Civil War as we are now, although we don't have the geographical divide and the single issue based on a geographical, you know, divide that would be able to cause a secession. But I do worry about the kind of potential for violence and war and some of the language that we hear today.
What do you hope the reader of this book gains from it?
Well, I hope that a couple of things. One of the things that I wanted to do was tell these stories, and I really think the stories themselves of the individuals are interesting. But I also think that historians have traditionally, for all kinds of reasons, and I've done it myself, reached for the low-hanging fruit in the historical record, and we've explained away why we haven't done other kinds of histories, particularly, say, the history of enslaved people, because it just can't be done because the records aren't there. So another thing that I hope people get out of the book is the recognition that this history can be done. It's not easy to do. It's not like having every letter or document that George Washington ever wrote available to us still so we can keep going over it and over it. But it can be done, and we must do it, and we must turn people whose names were buried into human beings with full lives and bring them to our consciousness as part of our historical fabric. So,
well, thank you so much for this work. And Elizabeth Leonard, I appreciate your time. Elizabeth is the author of Slaves, Slaveholders, and A Kentucky Community's Struggle Toward Freedom. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Slaves, Slaveholders, and A Kentucky Community's Struggle Towards Freedom is a publication of the University Press of Kentucky and online at kentuckypress.com. The Joseph Holt Home is located on State Highway 144, about a mile west of Addison, Kentucky. It sat vacant for 40 years. The slave quarters that were located behind the kitchen have been removed. Efforts are now underway to restore the home. This year's 11th annual Holt Home Community Day is on September the 28th. Coming up after the break, why are so many Americans having trouble connecting what they have learned with the skills and talents demanded by today's employers?
You know, I think everyone is tired of the blame game of sort of pointing the finger, right? Higher ed pointing the finger at high schools, and business pointing the finger at higher ed, and everybody's sort of in the circular blame game of who isn't doing their job, and that's not helpful to anyone.
Cheryl Oldham with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce tells of a new strategy to help business do a better job of communicating to educators about the kinds of know-how, skills, and talents they need. And we have an example of how just such a connection is being made here at EKU and on the university's satellite campuses in communities that are close to regional airports. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the Alltech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of just one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th through 21st, 2019, in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Fed Chairman Jerome Powell was recently on Capitol Hill urging Congress to find ways to get more Americans working again. He called it a very troubling concern that U.S. labor force participation is so low compared with rates in other countries, especially for young men and for women. One big problem seems to be a misalignment between education or training and the talents and skills demanded by today's labor market. Leading the effort to connect those dots is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and for about a year now, Kentucky has been engaged in a pilot project to implement the Chamber's Talent Pipeline Management Strategy. Joining us from Washington is Cheryl Oldham, the Chamber's Vice President for Education Policy. Greetings, Cheryl.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us. And first, I'd like to ask you, if you could, to describe for us the misalignment that's evident today between prevailing workforce talents and what the business community needs out of its workforce pool.
I think we don't go a day here without hearing from a member of the chamber, a senior business executive that says, you know, even in this tight labor market, we are having a difficulty finding the talent that we're looking for. And there's lots of statistics out there, 60% of jobs going unfilled for extensive periods of time, 40% of businesses say they can't take on new work because they haven't filled critical positions within their enterprise. And so it's impacting the bottom line. And I think education is certainly part of that. Our workforce training system, our higher education system. We often talk about needing more business education partnerships to make sure that we get that alignment right so that the business community is being really clear about what they want and need, and the education and training community is being responsive to that. But we have found over the years that those partnerships are not so robust and aren't actually creating those real career pathways that we need. And so that was sort of our kind of clarion call for us here at the chamber to say, okay, how can we fix that? And so that's, you know, our talent pipeline management effort is an effort to do that.
If you had to characterize it, how serious would you say this gap is between the talent that exists out there and what business really needs going forward?
You know, I think this has existed for a long time, and there's certainly lots of, you hear the other side of the story, right, that says, well, there isn't actually really a talent gap. The business community just doesn't train its people the way they used to, and if they just trained more, there would not be a gap. Well, I think that actually isn't the case. Hundreds of billions of dollars annually by the employer community in training and retraining and upskilling. And there are certain things that we just need from the education system in order to do the educating and the training on their part. And then there's certainly a lot that the employer community can do. But if you see, you know, we've got 6 million jobs going unfilled across the country. We've got over 6 million people who want to be working that aren't. And so how is it that we have as many jobs as we have people looking and we can't make those connections? So it's our opinion that part of that is a real gap in the skills, right? We can't find the people that actually have the things that we're looking for, but there's also part of that is a communications gap. And so that's another project that we're working on at the chamber is to address that. And that is to say, are we being very clear in the employer community with what exactly the skills and competencies and credentials that we need? What are those? And are we being clear? And are we signaling to the job seeker, to education and workforce trainers, what it is we're looking for? And if we get clearer about that, then maybe we won't miss people who are actually out there with the skills and competencies that we're looking for.
We recently talked with Beth Davison of the Kentucky Chamber about this talent pipeline concept and better organizing and aligning workforce and business needs data. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to ask you to tell us about the Kentucky Chamber's role in the next phase of this strategy, something called the Job Data Exchange, or JDX.
Right. When we created Talent Pipeline Management, the idea was we really needed to start with the employers in this whole skills gap conversation. And instead of sort of starting with employers and educators and trainers and bring everybody together and try to have a conversation about how to fix it. Or as we had been doing as a country for many, many years, we were sort of leaving it to the education and workforce trainers to say, build the curriculum, build the training system, build the education system to be responsive, but those partnerships with business weren't real robust. So we decided, look, we're the chamber, our members are the business community, the employer community is who we speak to. Let's start with them and say, there's work that the employer community needs to do on the front end before you go and build that partnership with an education or workforce provider. You need to do your homework and really figure out what are your critical positions that you need filled, what are the competency and credential requirements, do the data analysis within your own firm to say, where do we get our best talent, build those talent supply chains with your most trusted and preferred providers. And so we did that, and the Kentucky Chamber has been a part of that and really has been a model in the country for really taking this approach and building it out statewide. So what we discovered as we were going through and building talent pipeline and implementing it across the country was we had this signaling gap, this communication gap. We needed a better way for the employer community to be very clear about the skills and competencies that they're looking for through job postings. And so that is the JDX project, and we're piloting it with communities across the country. There's 8, I believe, in total, and Kentucky is one of them. And they're going to help us build this open data resource that will ultimately be available to anyone to use. And the idea that it will be very clear and you'll get real-time information about what employers are looking for and when those job postings change or when those skill requirements or credential requirements change, it'll all happen in real time. And as a education or workforce provider, a higher education institution, a community college, anybody who's looking and wanting to track what it is industry is wanting and needing in terms of skills and competencies can be receiving that information in real time.
Is this the kind of thing that admissions officials, for example, at universities, at colleges around the country, might want to keep track of so that they can be aware of what the workforce is going to be demanding 4 years down the road and what kinds of students might be interested in the programs that they offer?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, the really interesting thing about all of that is we sort of want admissions counselors. We want counselors in higher education and even in the K-12, in the, you know, high school system. We want these folks who are strapped, right? I mean, these are hard positions that have, you know, few for a lot of students. In many cases, we want them to be up to date on the latest that's happening in industry and in careers. And they're not always equipped to have that information. So the more that we can do on our end, on the employer side, to be very clear about what it is we want and need, then we are all better if we're working together on this. And we're certainly, you know, I think everyone is tired of the blame game of sort of pointing the finger, right? Higher ed pointing the finger at high schools and business pointing the finger at higher ed. And everybody's sort of in the circular blame game of who isn't doing their job. And that's not helpful to anyone. And so I think we're just trying to do what we can to help fix the parts that we can fix.
I wonder if there isn't a larger force at work here. I mean, given the unrelenting pace of technological evolution and change going on these days, does this strategy have some way to anticipate what the market will look like when today's high school senior graduates from college or a training program?
You know, I think that's going to be really hard to sort of say, you know, in 5 years, what are the jobs going to look like? Or in, you know, a few years or 2 years. I mean, as you said, the pace of change is like nothing we've ever seen before. And so what we need to be doing, and Kentucky is a great example of this, they've built something into the K-12 system of late that's called the essential skills piece. And that really is an effort to say there's something beyond the hard skills, right? There is a set of skills that we know students will benefit having there's certain things that we know they're going to need regardless of what the hard skills are that are required, that are going to be sort of timeless in terms of being able to respond to the pace of change and be a lifelong learner and be prepared to shift and be agile when those jobs change. Because I think that's what the experts say is going to happen, right? We just aren't going to know how technology is going to change the jobs of the future. But we do know that we're going to have to sort of be lifelong learners from now on. The idea of just going and getting an education to do one thing is probably not realistic from here on out.
For a time now, and maybe this is beginning to change, but for a time now, there has been something of a barrier between STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, versus the humanities and liberal arts.
Yeah.
In today's market environment, is it an either-or proposition, or is there a demand for a more balanced blend of the two?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, a lot of industries do need those STEM skills. So that's important and really, you know, important to focus on. But as you said, this idea of humanities or liberal arts, it's not an either or. And so I don't think that, I think if anybody has sort of suggested, you know, you sort of need to go all in on the STEM side and not worry about the critical thinking, the analytical reasoning, the communication, the teamwork, all of that, that really I think a classic liberal arts degree is probably or should be really good at providing that sort of foundation and education. And I think it really is, you know, why can't we have both?
Okay, Cheryl, I'm going to put you on the spot here and ask you to summon your prescience and look way down, let's say a decade from now, looking forward. How do you think this strategy, the talent pipeline management strategy, will have impacted or changed our economy?
Two of the most important things that this strategy will do is, one, it's going to fundamentally change, and it already has begun, this idea of how do we align our education and training with what is needed in the marketplace. And that's not to say that education has to all be about creating individuals who will, you know, all make widgets or whatever. But like, we go to school because we want to be successful. We want to be able to get a job when we get out. We want to contribute to our community and to society. And we want to raise a family, maybe, and have a sustained contribution to the economy. And so I think this idea of really transforming how that alignment works is critical. And we just have not done it over the years. And the result is where we are today, which is, you know, we're not creating those education and training pathways that actually lead to real jobs. And so that'll be, I think, transformational. And then the signaling piece, I think once we get the technology right, we're just going to know right off the bat, and higher ed and any education or training provider will be able to shift what it is they're teaching, what it is they're training, to be responsive. This is about the person, right? It's about the student. It's about the worker. It's about making sure they have the latest training, the latest education, so that when they get out, they are ready to go and they have opportunity like they've never had before. And it really will be the great equalizer, I think. It'll allow us to really focus on skills and competencies as opposed to a piece of paper that's supposed to say that you know and are able to do certain things. And this will allow us to really focus on what are the skills that you actually have, and do they connect to what employers need?
Cheryl Oldham is Vice President for Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and she is Senior Vice President for the Chamber of Commerce Foundation. And she talks to us from Washington. Thank you so much, Cheryl.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
One skill set that is in demand and likely will be for the foreseeable future is the aviation maintenance technician, and it offers an example of how higher education is realigning to meet that demand. It's right here at Eastern Kentucky University.
And here to fill us in are Melissa Newman, Director of Regional Stewardship at EKU, and Dr. David McFadden, Senior Vice President for Operations and Strategic Initiatives at EKU. And thanks to both of you for stopping by. Now, you got some good news recently, word that the Appalachian Regional Commission is investing $1.4 million in an aviation maintenance technician training project that's being developed here at EKU. Is this a response to demand for people with these skills? Melissa, do you want to answer that one?
Yes, absolutely. In the near future, we're going to have an 11% growth in this industry. And one of the things that we do as a regional stewardship arm of the university is we go out and we seek partnerships and we seek answers to how to diversify the economy. And while we're out there, we find these things. And there was this gem out there that people were saying that they needed the aviation mechanics program because there was a need that needed to be fulfilled. And we were able to bring this program.
David?
Tom, I think first we would really like to thank the Appalachian Regional Commission for investing in Appalachian, investing in EKU, and investing in this idea. As the only university in Kentucky that offers a flight program, it's a natural extension to move into the aviation mechanics because as we think about flight, we've got to think about all those ground operations and how those planes are ready to get up in the air and that they're safe and that safety is first. But as we think about the Department of Local Government, who is a critical partner in us bringing this to fruition, we realize that aerospace and aviation is the number one industry in Kentucky. And if we're going to continue to lead in that space, we're going to have to make sure that we're expanding our footprint. And the ability to do that throughout eastern Kentucky with this program is going to be an immense opportunity for those who are in the Appalachian region.
So as I understand it, you're building the curriculum for this now. It hasn't started yet. Maybe tell us about the curriculum and when it will get underway.
Right now, we've put together a team of experts from Eastern Kentucky University who are helping to navigate the process for the FAA curriculum. The process takes almost a year to complete. One of the reasons for that is because we do part of it and then the FAA comes in and they look at it to make sure that it's okay. So it's a very strategic process that takes a long time. And this is why we are starting the first cohort of students in January 2020.
Tom, I would say that EKU currently operates an FAA 141 license for our flight program. The team that is working with Melissa has an intimate knowledge of working with the FAA and putting together those parts and pieces that are essential to not only get one of these programs off the ground, no pun intended, but to maintain it and to make sure that we stay in compliance and that those students who go through the program are going to be very successful and they're going to be in high demand when they finish the program.
So somebody listening to this conversation might get the impression that this is happening just here at EKU in Richmond. But it's more extensive than that, correct?
We are going to have aviation mechanics programs at Big Sandy Regional Airport with a partnership with Big Sandy Community and Technical College, Wendell H. Ford Airport in Hazard with a partnership with Hazard Community and Technical College, London Corbin Airport with the partnerships that, of course, exist with our regional campuses there, Eastern Kentucky University Corbin Campus and Eastern Kentucky University Manchester Campus. And so we'll have these four airports in addition to Eastern Kentucky University in Richmond with Central Kentucky Regional Airport in Madison County.
And I guess this would be quite a lift for those regional airports as well.
Well, I think that it creates a lot of opportunity for those airports as we think about the infrastructure that's been invested in there to be able to bring a program like this is going to bring a lot of activity, which obviously creates some challenges, I imagine, but it will create immense opportunities for those airports to be able to bring additional resources to the table from the FAA and from their community partners to invest in those airports to really be a player in the aviation and aerospace industry and be able to be a part of that economic growth that's going on across the country.
Who or what kind of student do you think, especially, let's say, a high school junior or senior who's thinking about what they want to major in college or what kind of training that they want to be certified in, that kind of thing, who do you think might take interest in this kind of program?
You know, Tom, I think there's going to be two distinct populations of students that we talk about, and you alluded to one, and that is that career pathway for a high school student or maybe even a middle school student who has an interest in aviation and aerospace, that they would make that decision early on They would take the coursework that is needed. They would prepare themselves, whether it's for flight or in this case for the technical aspect of working in power plant or airframe or even avionics. There's an immense opportunity for that student population. The other part, which is critically important to this grant and critically important to what we do, is really for those individuals who want to retool themselves for this new economy. And whether it be a displaced coal miner or whether it be an individual who's working within the Appalachian region who thinks they want to be entrepreneurial, try to engage in this new growth space for innovation in aerospace and aviation, that those adult learners could come back, they could work through this program, and they can make themselves very viable in this new economy for particularly the AMT program.
And Melissa, do I understand correctly that the program is going to offer paid training to certain individuals?
It could. We are in the process right now with Eastern Kentucky Concentrated Employment Program to navigate the paperwork necessary to have this particular training listed on the eligible training provider list for workforce innovation and opportunity dollars. So it could be that if we pass this first hurdle and get these actually on those lists, then someone could get partially paid for training or completely paid for training, depending upon what the criteria is and what their circumstances are.
And what's the average pay for an entry-level aviation maintenance tech?
We're looking at from 2017, right around $70,000. And if we're also looking at displaced coal miners, that's about the same salary that a coal miner would bring in.
And this actually gets underway next year, 2020?
Yes. January 2020, our first cohort of students will be enrolled, and we plan on graduating 86 aviation maintenance technicians during the three-year course of the grant.
Before we run out of time, a question for each of you. All three of us sitting here are Eastern Kentuckians, and I imagine that it means a lot to both of you to be in a position to have an impact on the region's future.
Well, Tom, I think at our heart, Eastern Kentucky University is a school of opportunity. As a first-generation college student from Appalachia, that's exactly what EKU provided for me. And so I attribute my personal success, my professional success to the opportunity I was given by this institution. So our work in this space to provide opportunity for those in Appalachia and Eastern Kentucky to participate in the new economy, in an economy that is growing and where success can be found, we want to be the partner who can bring that to be a reality for them. And so I take a lot of pride in that. I have a great team. Melissa and her team do great work throughout the region as we serve Eastern Kentucky, which is our namesake at Eastern Kentucky University. We want to make sure that we're making tomorrow better than today, and that is really the creed that we live by.
And Melissa, what's your take on that?
As somebody who hails from Eastern Kentucky, I can say that without a doubt, we have people there who are ready, willing, and able to work, and they need these opportunities. And to be able to work with Eastern Kentucky University and to be on David's team and to be able to bring something like this across the finish line for the people who we care so deeply about, I'm honored.
Melissa Newman is Director of Regional Stewardship at EKU, and Dr. David McFadden is Senior Vice President for Operations and Strategic Initiatives at Eastern Kentucky University. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Coming up after the break, global hookups for local entrepreneurs and how telemedicine can be a lifesaver in rural cases of sexual assault and domestic abuse. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the Alltech Ideas Conference. One is an incubator of innovation, a forum for future thinkers, and a platform for propelling forward the promise of a planet of plenty. Attendees view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives in order to make a difference in the world. Learn more about One19 in Lexington, May 19th through the 21st, 2019, at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson.
Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
So you're one of Kentucky's hundreds of small businesses, and you're producing something that you hope will bring the world to your door. But often, becoming an exporter of your wares takes a lot more than building it and hoping they will come. It takes getting out there and making connections, building trust. But how? Aaron Persley is Executive Director, International Affairs and Business Development in the Cabinet for Economic Development in Frankfurt. We wanted to know more about the State Trade Expansion Program, and he's here to fill us in. Thanks for joining us, Aaron.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, what does the STEP program do?
Well, the State Trade Expansion Program is really to help small and medium-sized businesses expand their trade opportunities for their service and products overseas.
And who's eligible?
Any small business that is in good standing with the U.S. government and with the state government are eligible for the State Trade Program. This means companies who are considered small under the definition of being a small business by SBA.
So you sign up, you are accepted. What are the benefits?
The benefits are you can use some of our funding. So for years, the state funding for the STEP program was about $5,000 per company per year. Most recently, this past cycle, we were able to extend that to $10,000 that can be used by each company to export and promote their programs overseas. This includes being able to create websites for foreign governments, tour overseas, visit partners and clients overseas, and go to trade shows.
I read recently, I think it was in the Lane report, about a company that used its grant money to travel to China to set up business there for the Olympics would be one example. Can you give us some other examples?
Yeah, so that company that we were talking about was actually called Ski Scooties, which is based out of Louisville, Kentucky, really a mom-and-pop operation that's going to be working with the Chinese government on the Olympics, the next Olympics that come up. We have other companies in a variety of sectors. I'd be embarrassed if I started to mention off names one by one, but we have companies that are into distillery. They're doing operations overseas in Japan. We have companies that are selling conveyor belt products in the Middle East, things of that nature. So a variety of products from small companies across the state.
And so this comes down from the Small Business Administration, and then you administer it? Is that how it works?
Yes. So the Small Business Administration actually funds the grant for the STEP program. States apply for that funding. If you win the grant, then you get those monies. This is the biggest year we've had as far as funding from the STEP program. We're talking roughly around $700,000 this year we have in funding, over the $500,000-plus we had last year.
So it rolls over this time?
This time it rolls over. So we're able to use some of the funding from our last cycle for this cycle, and we got new funding for 2019 as well.
Do you have a lot of companies knocking at your door?
You know, we have quite a few companies that we've worked with. So over the course of the program, we've worked over 325 different companies. Just this year alone, we've worked with 80 companies, small companies across the state.
Now, I've read that you're making a special effort to reach out to veteran, minority, rural-owned companies. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so for years, our program has kind of been kind of first come, first served basis. We didn't do a lot of outreach to different kinds of companies. When we came on board this year, we wanted to make sure that we did more outreach to companies that were exactly like you, as you mentioned, rural companies, veteran-owned companies, minority-owned companies, because we want to spread the funding around to a lot of different types of companies and have more diversity in our program.
Can you tell us how STEP is aligned with the Kentucky Export Initiative?
They are directly aligned together. In fact, the members of the Kentucky Export Initiative, which include the World Trade Center, Kentucky, the Small Business Administration, the U.S. Department of Commerce local offices, and KCED, our cabinet, all work together on the STEP program. So, in fact, we put this grant forward each year. All those parties come together to review and write the grant for the STEP funding for Kentucky. And then we program and work together to get those funds out to small businesses around the state. So it's a cooperative effort between all the parties that are part of the Kentucky Export Initiative.
And do you and your office actually help a business identify potential export markets out there in the world?
So, yes, to a degree we do. So this is where that partnership comes in. So the World Trade Center Kentucky and the U.S. Department of Commerce have a lot of events, trade shows they promote throughout the year. So any STEP client that wants to go to those shows, it has automatic approval to attend those pre-qualified shows. Also, working with the World Trade Center and the U.S. Department of Commerce and SBA, they help those companies to also identify shows in their sectors that may be of good value to them.
Okay. Anything that we've missed here that you'd like to mention?
Well, I just want to say that, you know, Although we're trying to do a better job of diversity in our program, we can always do more. So I encourage people to apply for the STEP program. Go to our website, which is www.kyexports.gov, and explore the STEP program, see if you're a good fit for the program, and allow us to help you export your products overseas, promote your activities, and increase exports from the state of Kentucky.
Aaron Persley is Executive Director, International Affairs and Business Development in the Cabinet for Economic Development in Frankfurt. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sir, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
In rural parts of the Ohio Valley, qualified therapists are sometimes hours away from people who need help. That's a real problem in cases of sexual assault and domestic abuse, when such services can make all the difference between life and death. WEKU's Mary Meehan paid a visit to a rural clinic in Wyoming that's using telemedicine to connect with survivors of sexual assault.
Just like in the Ohio Valley, geography complicates treating sexual abuse and domestic violence in rural Wyoming. University of Wyoming psychology professor Matt Gray explains that there is not much between his office in Laramie and his clients in Gillette.
Yeah, it's vast, unimpacted, wide sweeping plains and lots of antelope.
Gray, by the way, is the encouraging kind of guy who says, "That's a great question," and sounds genuinely sincere. 10 years ago, the question he faced was how to provide therapy across the high plains. The solution? Encrypted computers make the connection. Graduate students provide specialized trauma care with the goal of helping survivors define themselves outside of the abuse.
Because when somebody's so beat down and when all of their focus and all of their peers or relatives' focus is on this relationship, is on staying and leaving, it's a lot of pressure, and this becomes the totality of the person.
Gray says using graduate students is key. It keeps costs down and ensures the quality of care. Students apply to the program from across the country. Student Kendall Binion from Georgia gets tears in her eyes as she talks about one woman who made a lasting impression.
I had one client in particular who went 40 years without telling anyone what happened because there wasn't the services to provide any help for her.
Stephanie Amaya from Los Angeles is also on the current team. She says she's been surprised at the strength of a connection shared via pixels on a screen.
But I found that human connection is transcendent. It doesn't depend on proximity. It depends on empathy and a willingness to share and to open up and to support someone who needs that support.
Gray's research shows telehealth is helping survivors heal, but funding remains a challenge. Most available grant money is tied to innovative uses of technology. Less is available to cover actual treatment costs.
But there's no shortage of rural populations that could benefit from this.
Eileen Rechtenwald is the executive director of the Kentucky Association of Sexual Assault Programs. She says telehealth could work in Kentucky. She says younger people especially are ready to access services in new ways.
They will access services via chat or internet, and sometimes, especially in Kentucky, that's not really available.
Margie McWilliams is executive director of the Gillette Abuse Refuge Foundation, which uses the telehealth clinic. She says something else is happening. It's a cultural shift that is both quiet and broad. About 60 people turned out in Gillette for a women's march in January. McWilliams and her coworker, Shauna McDonald, say the show of support matters.
To me, that was a big thing that's changed. We've never had that many people involved before. And of course, we got the trucks that drove by and, you know,
flipping people off.
And, you know, we've had the negative part of it too, but it was cool because nobody cared. We were just there for a reason. And we have seen an increase in our services and sexual assault victims are coming in.
The march drew people from even more rural parts of the state. Two moms drove from the next town over, Sheridan. It's 104 miles one way. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Mary Meehan.
This story was supported by the Solutions Journalism Network. The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and WEKU. Kentucky's incarceration rate has gone nowhere but up in recent years. And as Sydney Bowles reports, there's new research showing that many cash-strapped counties across the state are increasingly making ends meet by counting on revenue from holding state prisoners.
The Kentucky Department of Corrections pays a county jail about $31 a day to hold a state prisoner. That's half what the state pays to house prisoners in its own facilities. As of 2016, Kentucky held 48% of its state prison population in county jails. That's about 11,000 people. With this system, the state saves money and avoids overcrowding, and local officials get a much-needed influx of cash. But Judah Shept, one of the report's co-authors, says the system gives county officials an incentive to keep jail beds full.
I think it's a bit of an indictment on state priorities and on our larger sort of political imaginations that we rely on jails and prisons as sort of pivot points for the sort of basic needs required to improve people's lives, like extending water lines and renovating old wastewater treatment infrastructure.
Fulton County in western Kentucky holds the record for percentage of inmates from the state system. According to the report, 94% of people held in that county's jail are state inmates. Harlan County in eastern Kentucky has seen its population decrease, but its incarcerated population has risen by 1,500% since 1978. A lot of that increase, the report says, is from prisoners sentenced in the state system. A Harlan County official quoted in the report said nearly two-thirds of the county jail budget, or $1.8 million, comes from state payments for housing inmates. Shep says this practice can make governments dependent on the status quo of criminal justice policies. If Kentucky reduces the number of people it incarcerates, rural counties would be left to pay for outsized jails and to handle another significant drop in revenue. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Sydney Bowles.
Finally, this is so annoying. Are you getting these robocalls on your cell phone throughout the day, every day? Many of them masquerading as a local number, so you're never quite sure whether you should answer or ignore it. Some of these calls can be downright dangerous. Kevin Willis of member station WKYU tells us that the Attorney General's office in Frankfort is again hearing widespread reports of a scam involving so-called suspended Social Security numbers.
The calls appear to come from a real phone number with the Social Security Administration. The robocall claims the victim's Social Security number has been suspended because of suspicious activity. And to use the number again, the victim must verify it along with other personal information.
Now, if I don't hear a call from you, we will have to issue an arrest warrant under your name and get you arrested. So get back to me as soon as possible. Thank you.
Formal complaints about the scam have been filed over the past 6 months with the Kentucky AG's office from counties across the state, including Boone, Callaway, Fayette, Hardin, Henderson, and Jefferson. The same scam was so pervasive across the U.S. last year that the Federal Trade Commission issued an alert after more than 35,000 people reported financial losses totaling more than $10 million. I'm Kevin Willis in Bowling Green.
That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions, with the support of 1, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. Information about Eastern Standard content partnerships can be found online at esweku.com. And now you can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app, available for Apple and Android devices. Eastern Standard is also available as a podcast, and you'll find us on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.